and welcome to the Muni Lowdown. My name is Paul Graves, and I'm the managing editor for DebtWire Municipals. Today's podcast title is Pricing Climate Risk. I'm joined by our curation editor, Stephanie Fagnani, and Dr. Erica Smoll, senior research analyst for Breckenridge Capital Advisors. We'll be discussing the concept of pricing climate risk in the municipal market. Welcome back to the podcast, Stephanie.
Good morning to both of you.
And Dr. Smoll, first, can I call you Erica?
Yes, you can call me Erica. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Erica. Welcome to the podcast for the first time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So in preparing for today's discussion, I was thinking about the whole idea of risk in my mind. And I think about risk as something that means more things can happen than will happen. I think about intelligent risk-taking, meaning that understanding what you're up against. And when I try to put that together with investing, that's about preparing for a range of possibilities, not about predicting one single future. And today we're talking about this whole idea of pricing climate risk and the fact that we have these catastrophic weather events that are taking place. And something that I found that was interesting in the pre-production meeting, you had mentioned that the climate science, I'm going to just paraphrase there, is mixed on the frequency of catastrophic weather events, but it's very definitive on the intensity of these events. And so I wanted to say all this as like a backdrop to the research piece that you co-authored back in November of 2024 with Adam Stern called Heating Up, the Muni Market Inches Closer to Pricing Climate Risk. And in that report, you cite that many municipal bond investment strategies are benchmark aware. What does that concept mean?
When we say benchmark aware, we mean that as investment managers, which we are here at Breckenridge, we're often trying to track a benchmark in terms of portfolio performance. So that benchmark will vary based on strategy, of course, but in general, we want our portfolios to perform similarly to a benchmark. And the reason for this is pretty simple. We want to keep our clients happy. If we were going to vastly underperform or deviate from a benchmark, that would indicate to our client that either A, they could be putting their money elsewhere and getting better performance, or B, that we were taking some sort of undue risk. And this is important in the context of climate risk pricing because names in the benchmarks that we track are names that most muni managers like us are going to hold. And this can create an incentive to overlook climate risks associated with these names.
And in your view, how resilient has municipal credit been in the face of catastrophic weather events?
So I guess that depends on your definition of resilient. But if we're going to talk about credit defaults or just default avoidance in general, municipal credit has been quite resilient post extreme weather events. There are, of course, a few exceptions, but in general, climate and weather-related defaults remain exceptionally rare. So a great example of this is Hurricane Katrina in 2005. In Hurricane Katrina, I believe 80% of the city of New Orleans was flooded, and the population was cut in half over the course of a year. So very significant impacts. There was no bond default, however. There were credit impacts, however. The credit quality was impacted and the city was downgraded to junk. It did take a few years to build out of that back to an investment grade rating, but again, no default. And there are several other examples of major disasters that didn't result in any sort of default either. So some of those examples are Hurricane Sandy and Hurricane Andrew. But I do want to reiterate, as we saw with New Orleans, credit can be impacted. Yet to date, the impacts have been, for the most part, pretty manageable, even in some major disasters. And this is mostly thanks to insurance proceeds, the federal government support, primarily in the form of FEMA dollars, and then the potential for the rebuild to either spur economic activity and or even result in increased assessed valuations and tax bases after the rebuild.
So, Erica, does there exist enough quality information to make a climate risk assessment?
I think that depends on who you ask. But in my opinion, yes, with some caveats. So these days, there are multitudes of third-party data providers that can give investors like us climate risk information. Also, issuers' disclosure of climate risk is improving every year. So we did an analysis internally where we read in a representative sample of official statements over the last decade plus. And what we saw is that a decade ago, only about 5% of official statements mentioned the phrase climate change, whereas these days, that number is somewhere between 30 and 40%. So that's a significant increase in disclosure about these risks. We're seeing regulators push for this too, namely the SEC. But the caveats that I was mentioning, it is definitely still true that the climate data can be confusing and sometimes conflicting. So there was this good analysis published in Bloomberg last year, perhaps you saw it, and it was highlighting the differences across these third-party physical climate risk data providers. And they were showing that there was basically a lot of variation in these climate risk numbers depending on which data provider you were using as an investment manager. And then where disclosure does exist, the quality of that disclosure can vary widely.
So in your research report, you talked about the role of supply and credit quality. Can you talk a little bit about that here?
Sure. I actually think these are two hugely important concepts for why the climate risk pricing signal has perhaps been a bit muted. So let's first talk about supply. So while last year we hit record supply in the muni market, in general, the market has stayed nearly constant at plus or minus $4 trillion in outstanding municipal debt. And this has not kept pace with the growth in other fixed income markets. And it's certainly not kept pace with the rise in demand for tax-exempt paper. So when there are more investors going after the same amount of tax-exempt supply, what that means is that prices are driven up and investors are more likely to overlook longer-term risks due to climate. And then as far as credit quality, I also think this is extremely important for people to understand. So we are still in a period of, generally speaking, exceptional credit quality in most regions and sectors around the country when you compare historically. And this became particularly obvious post-pandemic. So post-pandemic, COVID aid helped many state and local governments increase their reserves position substantially. And then there was very strong consumption after the lockdowns ended. And in some locations, or in many locations, record-breaking assessed valuations. So that aided revenues and tax bases in many corners of the country. And this better credit quality has likely contributed to less scrutiny of credit risks, especially those that are longer term in nature, like physical climate risk. And what's more, some of the states that have seen the highest growth are some states with some very high physical climate risk. Think Texas and Florida. So as such, these areas have actually seen pretty large improvements in their credit fundamentals over the last several years, despite this backdrop of elevated climate risk. All that said, I do want to highlight, and this is something that we wrote about over a year ago now. So we think we are at this point past what we call peak credit. We believe that happened sometime in late 2023. It's hard to pinpoint exactly when. And what we mean is that while credit is still really strong, we think that it's starting to decline, albeit slowly. So we're seeing more issuers with realized and projected deficits, and we're seeing some softening in consumer behavior and tax-based growth. And then some sectors are seeing more acute credit stress, and those are education sectors like K-12 schools and higher education, and then also hospitals. So again, credit's not falling off a cliff, but we do think it's softening.
And Erica, should we anticipate reduced private insurance coverage and federal post-disaster aid moving forward?
It is really hard to predict exactly what will happen in private insurance markets and with the federal government. But I would say to your answer, yes, it appears more likely than not that there will be reduced insurance coverage and federal disaster support as we move forward. So the reason for this is that we are actually already seeing a climate risk pricing signal in insurance markets, and we have been now for a few years. Insurers are pulling out of certain high-risk states and or are ramping up premiums significantly. And then we're seeing state-backed insurers of last resort being forced to step in. At the same time, reserves in FEMA's disaster relief fund are dwindling at faster rates every year. And the Federal National Flood Insurance Program, the NFIP, has been increasing premiums as well. And all this was happening prior to the new administration coming into the White House. And now we know that the new administration is very much focused on cutting federal costs and perhaps putting more responsibility on states.
So would you say the recent developments in Clyde, Texas, at all indicate a divergence in climate-induced stress between small and large issuers?
I would guess that the general public is probably not aware of what happened in Clyde, Texas. So yeah, as background, Clyde, Texas defaulted on certain certificates of obligation series in August of last year. And the default was definitely in part due to climate risk, in particular, an extended drought. But it also showed the negative impact of a smaller tax base, a weaker financial profile, and some governance issues. The city did not have much cash on hand, and it made the choice to default on the certificates, despite the fact that they also had a general obligation backing. So in Texas, these certificates are almost always secured by additional revenues, such as water and sewer revenues, but then also the GO backing. So compare the situation with LA. We don't yet know exactly what's going to happen with LA after these wildfires, but we do know that LA is the second largest city in the U.S., its tax base is massive, its economic situation is very strong, and its reserves and liquidity are robust compared to an issuer like Clyde. So while the wildfires were certainly horrifying and concerning, it seems likely that LA comes out of this without a significant blow to its credit. In general, I think it's fair to say that larger issuers tend to have more resources on hand to do just that.
So, Erica, with this backdrop that we've been discussing here, is the market closer to a climate risk premium?
It's a great question, and it's something that, frankly, we don't know the exact answer to. As background, when I was a PhD student, I wrote a paper with Breckenridge looking at a statistical analysis about if climate risk was being priced in the municipal market, specifically in the new issue market. And what we saw is that climate risk was not really being accounted for in bond prices. We're seeing some things happen on the secondary after disasters, like we saw after these LA wildfires. But we do think, very likely, we are inching towards a climate risk premium, even though it's going to be hard to predict exactly when this will happen. And the reasons for this are all the reasons we wrote about in our piece back in November and that we talked about today. So first, we have a changing insurance market. Second, we have better data and we have better data tools these days to assess climate risk. And then third, we see a change in credit quality in some locations and a deterioration in credit quality in some locations. It also seems likely that this could happen quicker if the tax exemption were in fact curtailed, but that remains an open discussion. And it's important to remember that with every major newsworthy event when it comes to national disasters, like the situation going on in LA, more investors are paying attention.
When I think about climate risk, probably the most vexing aspect to it is that you can't really predict it. We could have three wildfires in a row, we could have four snowstorms, or we could have nothing. And so it's really hard to kind of pinpoint what you should do for something that could very well just not happen because of whatever's going on with the weather. One of the reasons I wanted, and I was so happy that you guys decided to come on to the podcast, was that you guys have always been very thoughtful in your work. And this is going back many, many, many years. And I wanted to close with, in my mind, this is a difficult question, but I figure if anybody can answer it, Breckenridge can. How does Breckenridge assess climate risk?
As you've mentioned, this is something that we have looked at now for several years, and it's something that's very well integrated in our credit review process. We do use third-party climate risk data, like many asset managers, and we look at a whole range of environmental, social, and governance attributes of our issuers. When we're talking about physical climate risk, that's one component of that integrated environmental, social, and governance risk assessment. So what we do is, using this data from third parties, that gives us information about climate risk projected out using forward-looking models. We look at the magnitude of exposure alongside of resilience efforts. And then we also look at the magnitude of exposure alongside of other community attributes, like the age of its housing stock, the health outcomes of the community. These are important markers of community preparedness, and that's sort of what we're trying to assess alongside of the incoming exposure, so to speak, when we're talking about physical climate risk. One thing that I think is important for listeners to take away is that we generally consider physical climate risk as a risk accelerant. And so what I mean by that is that climate risk can make credit issues happen quicker, more acutely, more intensely. So for example, if an issuer has weaker reserves or elevated debt, those are credit weaknesses. If that same issuer also has elevated physical climate risk, we view the likelihood of those financial weaknesses further stressing the issuer to be a lot higher.
Stephanie, this is why I like having smart people on the podcast. Because at my next barbecue, I'm going to sound really smart when I talk to people about risk accelerants. I learned a new phrase today. Dr. Small, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Stephanie, thank you as well for the great discussion on the pricing of climate risk in the muni market. I'm looking forward to an ongoing dialogue on this subject. Just want to give a special shout out to our podcast producer, Anthony Phillips, who always makes sure that our mics sound right. And to our audience, I hope you found this podcast to be informative. Please support us by liking, sharing, or subscribing to Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Until the next time, thanks for joining us on the Muni Lowdown.